Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the LSC. I'm Nick Kitchen, Assistant Professor of Research Fellow in the United States Center, and I formerly directed the LSC Diplomacy Commission. I'm delighted to welcome this evening, on this rather wet Monday night, Tom Fletcher to the LSC. As I'm sure you're all aware, Tom was British Ambassador to Lebanon and the Downing Street Foreign Policy Advisor to three Prime Ministers. Online, he was also the Naked Diplomat, presenting a refreshingly unvarnished view of the work he was doing and showcasing how digital and social media tools can be used to engage wider publics. Today, Tom is visiting Professor of International Relations at New York University, visiting Professor of Diplomatic Practice at the Emirates Diplomatic Academy, where he serves as Senior Advisor to the Director and runs their 21st Century Diplomatic Skills Program. In tonight's lecture, Tom will explore questions of diplomacy after Brexit. With Britain plunged into uncertainty by the referendum, what does this mean for European and global diplomacy? Is citizen empowerment making it easier or harder to govern? And how can we ensure that diplomacy is part of the answer to the challenges of the 21st century and not part of the problem? For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSEBrexit. Please put your phones on silent. There's always one. This evening's event is being recorded and subject to technical gremlins. Will be made available online as a podcast on the usual LSE channels. And as usual, after the lecture, there'll be a chance to put your questions to Tom directly, or tweet them to the LSE Brexit hashtag, and I will try and get some of them into the discussion from the chair. Last but not least, the economics. Tom's book, Naked Diplomacy, Power and Statecraft in the Digital Age, will be on sale outside the theatre after the event, where Tom will be doing a book signing. But for now, can you please join me in welcoming Tom Fletcher to deliver his lecture entitled Post-Brexit Diplomacy.
Well, hello and good evening, and thanks, Nick, and thanks, everyone, for turning out tonight. I think our plan is to dismantle a bit of architecture here. Our plan is that I'll try and give a few general thoughts about where our diplomacy stands now as the UK and more widely, and then I'm very much looking forward to then getting on to a more interactive session both in the room and online. And despite the fact that the book is called Naked Diplomacy, there is no actual nudity involved this evening. So if that's what you're waiting for, then I'm sorry to disappoint you. So on the way over on the plane, I was handed the Economist's predictions for 2016. Many of you will have read it at the end of last year. There's not much point in reading it anymore. Now, being a pollster, being an astrologist, and being an economist prediction person are all pretty futile jobs. 2016 has been defined by its unpredictability, by its randomness, this sort of frantic, helter-skelter, logic-defying, irrational year that we've been going through, in which the three new words which have been formally introduced to the English language at this stage, with 2 months still to go, are LOL, OMG, and WTF. And of course, it's still not done. And I feel very strongly now that for the first time in my life, we really cannot take anything for granted about the period ahead of us. The next year, let alone the next decade. These are now extraordinary times, and 2016 is now the new normal, I fear. So today I want to just briefly touch on three of the symptoms of 2016, then try and work out some of the trends that link them, and then think about how we respond. First of all, we can't start anywhere else, I guess. Trump. I have a small confession to make. To my shame, I'm actually on Donald Trump's mailing list. And I got onto this because a while back they had this questionnaire on whether the liberal media was biased against him. And I thought, I'll take the questionnaire, if only to be the 1% who disagree with him. And by taking that questionnaire, of course, I was sucked in to the mailing list. And I was like a potential terrorist being gradually radicalized online. I couldn't tear myself away. And so I got emails from Newt Gingrich saying, can you advise us on how to win the election? And I emailed back saying, change the candidate. But they they didn't come back to me on that. I got an invitation to meet Donald Trump's daughter, which was very kind, in return for a $3 donation. Which I thought was a bit strange, but then we subsequently found out Trump's views on women in general. I got one questionnaire asking for advice on the debate and sent in a long effort on the need for tolerance and diversity in modern America. That one also didn't get a reply. But the reason I haven't unsubscribed, I mean, apart from this morbid fascination, and maybe this nagging thought that maybe he really cares what I think, doesn't he? I haven't unsubscribed because I'm just fascinated with the way in which Trump is taking the post-truth politics, this more allegedly authentic, direct language, these new ways of reaching out and connecting with people, and turning them against us as the human race. It's not pretty. It's language which is aggressive, macho, divisive and dishonest. And I think we should, many of us, be honest with ourselves about one thing, especially, I think in particular, many men. Somewhere, many of us have an inner Trump, which is narcissist, boastful, divisive, and that takes out the problems we face on people who are weaker than us. The difference is that most of us spend a lot of time working to contain and restrain our inner Trump. And most of us manage to find ways to do that by the age of about 3 or 4. But we work at it, and we get there. We contain that inner Trump, and we leave behind the locker room, or the men-only club, or the Ku Klux Klan meeting. And only occasionally does our inner Trump get a word in here and there. We evolve away from that. I think, actually, and we can debate this later, I think we've been quite blessed to live in the Obama era. Obama is a humble man with much to be arrogant about. And Trump is an arrogant man with much to be humble about. And I think deep down Donald Trump knows that. It's just that he's never learned to restrain and contain his inner Trump. And of course, just as we evolve to contain our Trumps, society has also evolved. That's the story of our history, is our evolution to restrain people like this. It's the evolution of reason over craziness in our history, of community over tyranny, and of honesty over lies. And of course, it's slow progress, and we have bad years and sometimes bad centuries, but painstakingly and with great sacrifice, we build those political systems to restrain individuals like this. And as a species, our strength is that we know that we are work in progress, that we're not finished, that we're not perfect. And actually, and it's sometimes controversial to say this now, no country has done more than that in recent centuries, more for that effort than the US. And it should be then the progressives, I believe, that are chanting USA and not the extremists. So November is, I think, the most important election anywhere in my lifetime. And we're at that dangerous point in the rise of a dictator when some are starting to hedge, just in case. And that is the moment, I believe, that we must speak out even more strongly wherever we are, including in diplomacy. You know, diplomats don't normally take sides or comment on an American election. We tend only to comment really on elections in places that are less powerful. But this is the exception, and I believe we are left with no choice but to speak out about the danger that lies ahead of us if America makes the wrong choice. Now, assuming Trump continues to implode, but not fast enough that he's not replaced on the ticket, the Americans will make that right decision. But there is a much, much bigger battle ahead of us now. Trump is just the first phase of that. And that is to ensure that it's much harder for the next Trump, wherever he is, to weaponize intolerance in the way he's done. And I believe that's a battle that we in this room cannot sit out. So what about the other 2016 theme that we cannot ignore? Brexit, our very own drama here. Depending on where you stand, either our Independence Day, a quiet revolution, or a suicide note. So I think the 23rd of June did mark the end of the 20th century, not just for us, but for Europe and beyond. But our defining moment for Britain in the 21st century is not the referendum itself, but how we now respond to it. And I think the period ahead is going to require a collective sense of purpose that we probably haven't had here since the Second World War. Over the summer, without actually planning it that way, I spent a lot of my time in countries which are deeply affected by Brexit. I was in Dublin, I was in Belfast, I was in Berlin, Gibraltar, all in the name of research, of course, for today. And it's very striking that while our decision was based, our vote was based on local factors, this has now become a great example of how decisions in one country affect so many others. Our localism has ironically made the case for internationalism. And in response, I believe that we in the UK are now going to have to marshal our best instincts and our best values against our worst. We're going to have to contain our inner Trumps. We have to show now, and it's a vital argument to win, that we have not suddenly become an intolerant or isolationist country. We need to have a worldview formed by having actually seen the world. And we have to take on this growing cynicism and rancor in our public debate at home and abroad. We need to disband the circular firing squad that we've had set up since that vote and try to find new alliances, forge new conversations between the progressive Remainers and the libertarian Brexiters. Not easy. And much will be about how we define ourselves at home, preserving the union so we have that progressive enlightenment running through our national debate, holding the gains of the Northern Ireland peace process together so we don't once again become an item on other people's to-do list. And I believe also blazing a trail for more hands in the power of individual citizens, so that whatever we now think of the referendum, it can come to be seen as part of a wider trend towards individual empowerment. But it's no longer enough for us to try to re-establish ourselves as some kind of island of liberty. We're also going to have to find a way to become exporters, as at our best moments, of global liberty. And that's also not a battle that we in this room, I believe, can sit out. The third symptom of 21st century change, extremism. So I was ambassador in Beirut when the Syria conflict began, and I lived through the 4 years in which it became the worst conflict of the 21st century. And I believe I'll spend much of my life trying to explain how we let this happen on our watch. And much of my time now is spent trying to deal with some of the symptoms of that conflict and trying to get those 1 million Syrian kids out of school back into school so they don't pay the price. But we cannot look at the challenges facing the world beyond without looking at Syria, because there's such a strong connection between the breakdown in the Middle East and the polarization in our own societies. And because Syria is the grimmest example of what happens when the international order fails. You get carnage, you get great power conflicts, and you get a petri dish for extremism. And I've seen that extremism close up. The three cities in which I've spent most of my adult life now, Beirut, Nairobi, and Paris, have all been ripped open by acts of terror. The sociopaths with smartphones have got our attention. But we need to be very careful here not to be misled about why terrorists attack these cities, these places. They attack what they call the grey zone, the places where cultures interact. Places like this room. And in doing so, they're pitching their camp on the wrong side of the 21st century's great argument, which is actually not between East and West and North and South and haves and have-nots, Christianity and Islam, but actually between those who believe that we can coexist across societies and those who have given up on that idea. And by doing that, those extremists have strengthened those in our own societies who share that outlook, who share that rejection of coexistence. And so the effort to close off our states to refugees or to migrants is a complete propaganda gift to Daesh, to Islamic State. Their publicity machine thrives on the Donald Trumps, on the bikini bans, and on any measure that makes Western claims of tolerance look even more of a hypocritical sham. Attacks on mosques or immigrants by white extremists. We had another one 2 days ago in America. Travel around the world in seconds. In the battle for modern Islam, we rely on the moderates prevailing, and yet too often we undermine their message by not standing up to our deeply held values. You will know this as well as I do, that those who see foreigners as in some way fundamentally different are the people who haven't met any. And however insecure we feel, the answer to these challenges is in fact more liberty, more equality, and more fraternity, not less. So we need to be on the right side of this argument. It sounds like some kind of idealistic argument, but it really is not anymore an idealistic argument. We need to be on the right side of the argument for tolerance and coexistence. And we need to take on the wall builders and the destroyers wherever they are. And that is not a battle that we in this room can sit out. So the connections then between Trump, Brexit, and this rise of extremism, I think firstly they show that in the West, we are clearly now in this age of distrust. Authority is devalued as a currency, not unlike another currency I could mention. The parliamentary vote on action in Syria in August 2013, against action in Syria, as I evacuated my staff and the families from Beirut, was rejected because Iraq had destroyed confidence in the foreign policy establishment. Staying in the EU was rejected in large part because MPs' expenses and the banking crisis and the other scandals had undermined confidence in Westminster and the Square Mile. Trump is a bombastic reality TV rejection of the Washington establishment and mainstream media. It's not a good time to be an expert. Second link, we've been reminded as if we needed to be, and you in this room don't need to be reminded, that history repeats itself. After economic downturns, nations turn inwards at the very moment when they should look outwards. They become nationalist when they should become internationalist. And all this despite the fact that we know from history that nations that turn inward become history's losers. Third connection between these trends, Trump, Brexit, extremism, is that these are all the initial implications of the internet age. In the next century, we're going to see as much technological change as in the last 40. It's like going from cave paintings to the atom bomb in a couple of generations. And there are huge positives to that, but there are also big challenges. It will put many businesses out of business, as you know. It will put many states out of business, many ideas out of business. Look at the impact of the printing press and scale that right up. There will be winners, but also many losers. Someone told me today that at LSE now, you can now order fresh pants at the click of a button, and they're delivered to LSE, should you need them. But someone has to service that on-demand economy. Someone has to be on-demand in order to deliver you those fresh pants. And the World Economic Forum now says that that inequality, that growing inequality, is the biggest geopolitical risk today. If displaced people had a country, it would be the 24th largest in the world. And we better mind that gap. We better mind that gap. So an age of austerity is combined with an age of migration and an age of massive technological change. And the effect has been to empower the extremists, the destroyers, and those who can't build anything but walls. So what do we do? What's our response as the UK? Well, I think we need to place ourselves much more confidently and assertively on the side of liberty and tolerance, and put a new sense of purpose at the heart of how we talk to the world, with liberty as the defining theme. The key here is to play to our strengths. When you travel the world, I live in Abu Dhabi, but I work mainly in New York, and you ask people what the strengths of the UK are, they come back again and again to our vibrant education sector, to our history as a trading nation, and to our creative industries, from Beckham to the Beatles to Bond. So we have to build our domestic recovery on those strengths, and also then be the vanguard nation for liberty in those areas. The freedom to learn, the freedom to trade, the freedom to create. And if liberty is our great idea, we can power that effort through our greatest inventions, electricity and the World Wide Web. We should be unashamedly and unequivocally leading this effort to build a world built on greater security, greater freedom and opportunity. More citizen, more digital, more networked. Less defined by institutions, by geography, and less by hierarchy. Before the referendum, I did a review of the Foreign Office with those recommendations and said that the role of British foreign policy was to promote positive change in a world of greater security, justice, and opportunity. And it was very easy, as some did, to dismiss that as idealistic do-goodery. Many would say that Brexit and the rest of 2016 buries those ideas even further. But I believe they resonate not just with British diplomats seeking a stronger sense of purpose and identity, but with those outside government. And if we are to double down on global liberty as our theme, then we have to fight for three global freedoms: the freedom of opportunity, the freedom to create, and the freedom to coexist. For moral and pragmatic reasons now, our greatest global challenge is making more people less poor. And if we fail to do so, we'll have more hungry and angry people heading in our direction. So our humanitarian offer as Britain should not be something we apologise for, that we're embarrassed about, that is some sort of bolt-on, that we're ashamed to talk about in case it enrages the Daily Mail. It should be part of what defines us as a nation. And an individual's freedom of opportunity cannot be defined by where they're born. And so we need to work harder to get education to 75 million kids globally who are out of school, so that they face more than this perilous choice between the people traffickers, the barrel bombers, and the extremists. On the creatives, we're a creative industry superpower. Our creative sector is the fastest growing sector in our economy, a central part of our soft power offer to the world. So we need to get our creatives out in front in the conversation we have with the rest of the world. And we have to get a proper education in creativity for our next generation and seek out with more vigour the new partnerships in the world. We can play that talismanic role as well, bringing together global creators. Our ability to actually get through the 21st century depends on the smartest people in the world getting together and using their collective ingenuity to crack these massive problems we face. So we should be unashamedly backing freedom of the internet everywhere. And we should be proud, too, that Britain is still magnetic, despite some of our best efforts to send different signals. We should be chasing students to come here, not chasing them away. We should be smart enough to recognise the economic potential of migrants, as we always used to, from Einstein to Steve Jobs. We were all migrants once, and the 21st century is a time of people on the move. So we need to learn how to absorb, assimilate, and coexist in that context. Two foreign policy points here on the freedom to coexist, to show you that it's not just an idealistic point. Firstly, we've got to start making some hard decisions on protecting the most vulnerable. Whether kids are in Gaza, Aleppo, or Mosul, when they're bombed, they all look the same. And I don't believe that we as a society have reached the limits of our compassion. It is staggering to me that elements on the left and right, but increasingly on the left, seem to think that our role in the world is to help Russia contain America rather than the other way around. And yes, I've lived through it. Iraq has absolutely scarred a generation of policymakers, making us fear risk more, corroding public trust in what we do. We're less willing to send people overseas to defend the nation state, let alone other nation states. And we're better able collectively to express those reservations. That's all a good thing. But we have to look back at similar moments of peril and uncertainty and learn the lessons. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I think, is basically mankind's greatest text, the closest thing we have to a set of global commandments. The problem is not that we don't understand our duty to our fellow global citizens, and I think we should be proud to call ourselves global citizens, but that we don't have the will to deliver it. And that needs a new debate. Britain can drive that debate, and we can rescue what was a very noble idea, the responsibility to protect. We can rescue that from the rubble of Syria. Because what really gives us that right to defend a liberal world order? Only our knowledge that the alternatives are much, much worse. Second foreign policy point on freedom to coexist. We've got to get stuck in on UN reform. Just because we're exiting from one bit of international structure doesn't mean we turn our backs on the rest. The scaffolding which we've built around global politics since the Second World War is very, very shaky. And in a way, my message coming out of government is we haven't got this covered. The UN doesn't have this stuff covered. We are going to need to find ways to reform if we are to tackle these big global challenges, migration, the economic uncertainty, infectious disease, climate change, terrorism. Just because we've decided to pool less sovereignty with Europe doesn't mean we should decide to pool less sovereignty with the world. Because in the absence of leadership and reform of the UN, those institutions that we've built, developed to protect humanity will just cease to retain any influence or relevance. And nature abhors a vacuum. So, I want to get on to some questions, but whether you agree with me on the referendum or Trump or Assad, it's clear we are in a new phase, surely. And there is this temptation, we hear it every day now, here in the UK, to pull up the drawbridge, to focus purely on domestic issues, nationalist policies. But let's be in no doubt that a retreat from the world is a path to irrelevance, drift and uncertainty. It's a path to becoming just one more sick man of Europe. And our national interest now depends on us rediscovering our internationalism. We've always been strongest when we're outward-looking, pioneering, trading, welcoming. There's no threat in the 21st century to which the answer is simply just build a big wall. And our international reputation now, if we don't get this right, the bedrock on which we build our economy and our creativity is really in the balance. But our resignation as a power was not on the ballot in June and should not be on the agenda today. 2016 shows that we haven't reached the end of history. I think we'd work that out. We've not had the last world war. We've not reached a plateau where somehow everyone agrees that liberal democratic values are as good as it's going to get. So we cannot put these global challenges in the too difficult tray while we have our own existential crisis. We can't wait for others to come up with all the answers. And we have a superpower. But like all superpowers, it depends what you do with it. You can download pictures of cute cats or Justin Bieber's hair or flirt with a person in the second row. But we've got to start using this superpower to really shape our environment. Twitter didn't create democracy. Democracy created Twitter. Liberty didn't create Facebook. Facebook didn't create liberty. Mark Zuckerberg is kind of... Really? I never claimed that. Liberty created Facebook. And what we do as humans is now changing at a faster rate than at any time in history. And it must be based now on our success in the past to manage these moments of peril. We've managed it, mainly, in the past. It must be based on our ability to master new tools and ways of interacting. It must be based on that fundamental belief that, like Charlie Chaplin in The Great Dictator, more than machines, we need humanity. This requires ceaseless creativity and innovation. The Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. And it requires courage to be on the right side now of these big arguments, to be on the right side of history. Because I don't think the greatest danger is anymore the atom bomb, the environmental catastrophe, the next disease, or the crazed terrorist, or even the robots. I think the greatest danger we face now is this loss of curiosity. This growing inability to learn from each other, to learn from history, and the loss of that desire to coexist. Because that desire to coexist, that pursuit of coexistence, is what's really been at the heart of diplomacy since the very beginning, since the first caveman stopped another caveman clubbing him over the head for long enough that they'd go out and hunt together rather than compete for resources. It's part of our DNA. And so this new technology that is at our fingertips now must enhance that part of our DNA rather than remove it, because it's as important to our survival as competition is. It's going to be an exhilarating century. But we better not screw it up. So let's not fail because of lack of ingenuity, because of lack of creativity or lack of curiosity. Let's not fail because of lack of courage. And many of you now are part of this most influential generation in history, and you'll be the ones that need to summon up that fresh will to defend the progress we've made, to defend the rule of law, to defend the freedoms we take for granted. I think the centre can hold, but we're going to have to fight harder for it. And I believe that is not a battle that we in this room can sit out. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, we have plenty of time now for questions. One caveat, although Tom said that diplomats should speak out, he is less than 2 years out of government, and that means government prevents him from speaking out on issues of current government policy. So if you want his opinion on Theresa May's shoes, you're going to have to get it from him privately afterwards.
I think they're great.
There we go. Breaking the rules already. Let us know your name and where you're from when the stewards come around with the microphones. Keep them short and to the point. If you're a nervous public speaker or you need the discipline of 140 characters, tweet me. And I'm going to take the chair's prerogative. I'm going to ask the first one. You presented a very kind of passionate call for liberty, almost do-goodery as realism here. What do you say to the people from rural America or Boston, Lincolnshire, who say, that's all very well for you. You live in Abu Dhabi, you work in New York, right? You spend your life in a global community that, you know what, we just don't access, that takes stuff away from us rather than bringing it back, that all of the structures that we had that sort of protected us from free trade in terms of social structures have been eroded by you guys. How do you bridge that gap from what we need to people's kind of feelings about what is being supported? Yeah.
It's a really good question. Thanks for starting with the hardest one. Make it harder. I mean, clearly we've got this massive issue in that we just haven't been, as policymakers, as people in places like this, we haven't been having the right kind of conversation with those who feel that they've lost out because of globalization and those who really have lost out because of globalization, and in particular have lost out because of that freedom of movement that I, as a migrant worker, enjoy, and many of us enjoy. I wonder whether it is not so much what we're saying, because I think the arguments are there for us to make, but it's about how we do it now. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, though I'm not sure it's on sale in deepest Texas at the moment, is to try and explain these issues and explain diplomacy in a different way, and hopefully in a way that can actually connect with more people. It was what we were trying to do in Lebanon as an embassy by using much more social media, trying to break down those barriers between people behind the curtain and people outside. Just trying to find new ways to broaden that argument and engage. It's really difficult to do, but my profession, diplomacy, has been very slow in doing it. And so we still, if there was a conference or a summit here today on any one of these massive global issues, we would issue a communique saying, we came together to discuss warm bilateral relations in an atmosphere of mutual concern about the, and you're gone. It doesn't, that stuff doesn't connect with people, doesn't really help to explain why what we're trying to do matters. So we have to find a completely new way of communicating. And part of that, only part of it, but part of that is using social media to cut through to people in different ways. If that's where the conversation is, then we have to go there.
Okay, great, thanks. Let's open it up to the room, make yourself, and wait for the mic. Back there, please. And we'll take them in clusters. Sort of, and one further forward. So two on the, just on the aisle there. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Gianluca, and I come from Italy. So my question is, you said about, talk about to create democracy, to defend the rule of the law. That's quite important topics, but nowadays there is not the risk in order to do that, to go against a kind of established system, and so to get a retaliation as a consequence.
Okay, we'll just go back five rows up there. Thank you.
Thank you for speaking to us. My name's Rohan, I'm from King's College London. You mentioned that Britain has particular strengths in trade and education and in creativity. Are you suggesting that Britain should embrace more of a soft power status, or do you think we can still embrace our status as a country that punches considerably above its weight?
Okay, do you want to take those two more?
So on defending the rule of law, my worry here, it's a bit like the worry I raised about some of these big issues like climate change and the global economy, is that I'm trying to sound an alarm here, that we shouldn't think that governments have this stuff covered. I've spent 20 years inside government. In 4 years in Downing Street, I was always hoping that at some point I would get close enough to the centre of power that I'd find a room full of really clever, smart, cynical people working on these issues. And I got closer and closer until I was the last person in the room, and I certainly wasn't thinking about more than the next day's Sky headlines. So my point is just don't think that you can leave this stuff to governments. And I say that, a big fan of many, many friends and colleagues who work in governments, but they no longer have the bandwidth to tackle those big issues at the national level or at the global level. So we need individuals to really start making those arguments day in, day out, and having those fights, and coming up with the ingenious ideas and the connections that will help us deal with some of these big challenges. Rowan, on soft power, yes, definitely. One of the things I do is to chair the International Advisory Council of the Creative Industries Federation, which is trying to promote that sector overseas in a more coherent way. We've got some brilliant tools. You know, the British Council, BBC World Service, the Premiership, Adele. You know, there's some fantastic stuff there to work with. But it's not always done in a very coherent way. The House of Lords concluded the other year, we kind of leave our instruments of soft power slightly lying around all over the place. We don't join them up very well. And so we have got to get better at that. And we've got, as part of that, I believe now in 2016, even more than 4 years ago at the time of the London Olympics, we've got to kind of have a stronger sense of our national story. And I don't mean that we're going to start having pledges to the flag and, you know, reciting, you know, the history of the Anglo-Saxons and so on. But that sort of sense of how these values of tolerance and diversity and liberty have been built up over centuries. We didn't just kind of come upon them. You know, we've worked really hard to get to this point. So helping ourselves understand that story so we can better tell it to people outside. But what I'm not saying, Rohan, is that we should just abandon all hard power as well. That we can rely on just doing soft power alone. Because as we're finding over Syria, if you don't have the ability to back up your red lines and to put a military deterrent on the table, then you get pushed around. You know, just to come back to the soft power point, you know, there's this story about when Stalin was criticised by the Vatican. He said, well, how many divisions does the Pope have? And of course, the Pope is still there and Stalin isn't. You know, so there is a much greater strength to soft power than we've often realised in the past. But it's not the complete package. You've got to have the hard power in there as well.
Okay, thanks. Let's take some more. One right down the front here. Lady in the glasses and the lady on the fifth row in the middle there. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you. My name is Basanti. I'm from the University of California at Davis. Thank you for speaking to us. So some people argue that one of the foundations of the U.S.-UK relationship is based on the fact that the U.K. is part of the EU and that Americans often use the U.K. as their gateway to connect themselves to EU negotiations, etc. With the fact that now the U.K. is leaving the EU possibly, how do you think that will affect the U.S.-UK relationship as we go forward when it comes to trade and economics, given that the U.S. election isn't going to get too crazy?
The lady in the back.
Thank you for the speech. My name is Jaran. I'm a graduate student here at LSE. 2016 provided us with many examples of how individuals abandon their freedom in an environment that lacks security. What do you think Britain should do in an international, in a national, and in a local level to increase security and increase the feeling of security among communities?
Okay, we'll take one more, Tom. Just the gentleman over here.
Yeah, my name's Tony Goodwin. I'm an entrepreneur. And I've just got to say a couple of things first before I ask my question. I have an international business, and I believe that the Brexit vote has got very little to do with the other two themes that you raised. I don't think there's a correlation. I don't think there's a link. I am very pro-Europe. I'm very against the EU, much in the same way as I love football and I don't like FIFA. And the same is true. I mean, I was on the phone this morning to India. Tomorrow I'm getting on a plane to Russia, and the month after I'm going to China. I think your interpretation, Tom, of the Brexit vote, because mine was based on bureaucracy, democracy, and sovereignty. It had very little to do with immigration. My wife is from an immigrant family, and I think that the interpretation of the Brexit vote by people like you is flying in the face of why many people voted Brexit. It's about common sense. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example of that with the NHS. They recently paid out $2 billion to managers that they then rehired. That wouldn't happen in a private enterprise. The bureaucracy of the EU is what is destroying the EU. Mm-hmm. And so I take exception to your interpretation.
It's not really a question, but you can address. You can address the point.
It's a very fair point. Where do we start? US UK. So I did several relationships between US presidents and UK prime ministers, from Blair Bush through to Obama Cameron. So I haven't done the latest version of it, but I saw those various versions, and there is a huge amount of that relationship, I believe, that goes well beyond the trading relationship and a long way beyond whether the UK is part of Europe or not. A huge amount on the intelligence and security and defence side. So I'm not too worried about that. Maybe I should be, but I think there's a resilience to that relationship. I think we completely overstate on the British side often. We love talking about the special relationship, and every time we prepared a press conference with a US president, we'd be desperate for them to mention those words, special relationship. But it's not a relationship that should be defined in how you describe it or how long the press conference is or how good the gifts were and whether Obama gave you a box of DVDs or something else. There is a whole load of stuff there which I think is more resilient, personally. So I'm not. That's not one of the things that keeps me awake at night compared to the rest of the list. On the communities, I think this is another point about citizen diplomacy. So when... Just an example from my time in Lebanon. Every time a bomb went off, one of the first things I would do would be to tweet to encourage people to surprise people with an act of tolerance. And again, this sounds like real do-goodery, but if a bomb goes off in a Shia area and you're a Sunni Beiruti, then doing something to show solidarity with those hit by that bomb may not be the first thing that comes to mind, and yet it is extraordinarily powerful if a load of people are doing it. So there is much more I think we can do to do those sort of slightly surprising acts of tolerance. On Brexit, by the way, I mean, I'd really want to be clear on this. I do not think that everyone who voted for Brexit is some kind of intolerant extremist at all. And that's why I made the point about, in this next phase, we've got to find a new way of talking between the kind of the sort of internationalist Remainers and the libertarian Brexiters. Because a load of people I know who voted Brexit did it for those sorts of reasons. A lot of it is about this empowerment of the individual and trying to take on the kind of bureaucratic elements, not just of the EU, but of institutions more widely. I went to tens of European councils when I worked in Number 10. And there are very few questions to which the answer is European Council. I sat through many EU coordination meetings in Beirut, and they're what my wife, who's a psychologist, calls emotional labour. They were just exhausting because we weren't getting stuff done. So I completely understand the bureaucratic point, and I completely understand why there are lots of people who voted Brexit, just as I understand why there are lots of people who voted Remain. I didn't actually say in the talk which way I voted, by the way, because I'm not allowed to. I maybe gave some clues, but I do understand that point. But I suppose my argument is that we've got to find ways to get on the plane to India, to get on the plane to Moscow, to show that it wasn't a vote for intolerance, because much of the world thinks it was, and there are some in our own societies who did vote out of intolerance. I mean, this would be Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables. It may be a very small amount, but we've got to show that that wasn't what the vote was about. I don't believe it was. I don't believe that 52% of Brits are close-minded and intolerant at all.
Okay, let's come down here to the second row just from the end, and then we'll go one down here as well. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dylan. I'm having my master here at LSE in politics and communications. I have a question about the impacts of Brexit on diplomatic power of UK. So is it obvious that UK diplomatic power will be diminished outside of EU? Or like Leafside argues that the Brexit will give more control or more independence to UK diplomacy?
Okay, thank you. We'll just come down here to this gentleman. Gentleman in the blue shirt, next.
Hi, thank you for the excellent presentation. I'm Hassan from University of Oxford, but I also work for the CBI of Turkey. My question is, to what extent you think these rising inequalities is causing this rising of the populists on the left and the right, and how that would impact on diplomacy? Thank you.
Thank you. And gentlemen here.
Thanks very much for the presentation. I'm Peter. I'm an American, recently naturalized as a British citizen, so have both the American and British perspective, having been here the last 6 years. I'm curious, you mentioned that to the extent that you know, Britain needs to continue to absorb, figure out how to absorb you know, all of the migrants, or not all of the migrants, but you need to be open and figure out how to absorb the flow of migrants. Seeing Britain as what some people, especially Americans, would consider like a welfare state, how does that need to evolve, or does that need to evolve over time?
Okay, thank you.
On diplomatic power, I think it's too soon to say. We don't know yet. I should probably be saying we will continue to punch above our weight and happy and glorious forevermore. But your diplomatic power depends to a massive extent on your economic power. And so if in 10 years' time our economy has taken a significant hit because of Brexit, then that will affect our diplomatic power. You know, quite literally it affects how many embassies we can open. I'm not saying the embassies are the be-all and end-all of diplomatic power. But it affects how other countries see you. It affects, you know, how easy it is to get the most powerful leaders in the world to pick up the phone and talk to your leader. All those sorts of issues depend on that economic foundation. And so that will be the key to it. But I think in the meantime, as we wait to see on the economy, there is this period when we have to be much more assertively going out there. So the rest of the world thinks that we're just having this midlife crisis, and we've got to show that, okay, yeah, we've had our summer. We are now going to set out in a new way our relationship with the world, and that goes. We're not going to be defined by Brexit. There is much, much more to us than this issue, and that's where I come back again to these issues around global liberty, where I think there is a niche for us on those issues and playing to our strengths. Creative industries, you know, the fact we're on the UN Security Council, the fact we have this fabulous network of diplomats around the world, believe it or not, you know, all that stuff is an important part of our toolkit, post-Brexit as well as pre-Brexit. Hassan, short answer, yes, very much. Rising inequality is a big part of it, but I also think this issue around trust and authority is harder to get hold of, but is also a big part of it. And the smartphone is a big part of that. There was a YouGov poll just recently saying that trust in doctors is down 10%, trust in teachers is down 15%. You know, anyone who's in a position of some kind of authority, maybe university lecturers, everyone is...
Always, yeah.
We're finding that, as, you know, it's not a good time to be an expert. You know, if you're in authority, people are that much more suspicious and cynical about why you're there. And so we have to find better ways to explain what we do. So let me give you a very practical example. If you were all arriving in Beirut tomorrow, and I was the ambassador, and I knew that in a week's time there was a real risk of a crisis. We had intelligence saying there was a bomb threat in Beirut. I now have the means to track you all through your UK mobile phone to know where you are. But I don't have the authority to do that. Now, I won't take a vote on it now as to whether you think I should have that authority or not. But yeah, this is one of those examples. Yeah, it's technologically, if I'm trusted with that data, I can keep you safer on your trip to Beirut. But I very much doubt that I would win a referendum on whether or not the government could be trusted to have all your mobile phones. So in that particular example, we developed an opt-in scheme where people would get a text message on arrival and they could reply and say, OK, contact me if there's a problem. But we're missing lots of people. And that's going to become harder and harder to establish that trust. And meanwhile, our opponents don't face these issues of transparency. You know, when we were doing Syria negotiations with the Russians, it was like poker, but Putin could see our cards. Because we were obviously, quite rightly, having our debates in public. So, you know, it's very difficult. It makes it very difficult to bluff. It makes it very difficult to do old-fashioned diplomacy when your cards are on the table like that. And that's a challenge we've got to work through. Peter, on migration to the UK, well, you're a positive example of it. I think over the summer, for my father's 70th birthday, we got him a DNA test, not a paternity test. A DNA test where you send off your a swab of saliva to the States, and it tells you basically where your family came from. I don't know how precise these things are, but it turns out that we were mainly Vikings. I was quite pleased to know. I personally think everyone in the world should take one of these tests. I think it would be a great way to take on intolerance and sectarianism and nationalism, because we'd all find out that we came from very many different places and that we were all migrants, perhaps not as long ago as we like to think. I'd be interested in Trump's DNA test. No, I wouldn't, actually. I'd just rather not know. But you get my point. I think I think that no one is out there making, in a sufficiently bold way, the case for migration. Not just of the most vulnerable, but also of the economically active as well. I think there's a completely different argument, a completely different debate we should be having about migration. And yes, as part of that, we need a much clearer definition of when people are eligible for benefits from a state that has raised that money from taxes of people living in that country already. Absolutely. But that isn't an excuse just to put up the walls altogether.
Okay, next round of questions. Let's come to the front here, and then up back in the middle in the red shirt, and the lady on the aisle.
Hello. Here.
Over there.
Simon, I'm a graduate student here. Thank you for your talk, a very inspirational talk. I'm wondering, how is it maybe too inspirational for the reality that we see? As a German following UK media, following the signs, the signals that are coming out of UK government, I would just like to get your view on how realistic you think it is that your vision will actually be implemented by a government or by the UK society in future years, and where you see these drivers. Because as I saw Brexit as an outside observer actually being in the UK while it happened, I think much of the response that we get out of government is coming from that tone in society, spreading in society, that is being picked up, this aversion to the EU. I always try to understand it, never could, like, where does it come from? And I think much of it, politicians understand, oh, this is actually not good for us, but this is what kind of the people want to hear. So how do we go about making your vision reality?
Okay, back there, yeah.
So. Hi, my name's Fergal. I'm from Dublin. Thanks for your words. I actually spent the last year in Beirut, so I just missed you. But
Fergal?
I was wondering what your thoughts are on what Brexit means for Ireland and the UK's relationship and the border in the north.
Okay, if we can just pass the microphone along and down to the lady in the jacket there. Lovely, thank you.
Hi. My name's Isabella. My question is quite, well, a simple one, but how do you think we can make our embassies more effective in the world and with the world? That's not actually a simple question. But could it be kind of as simple as doing more language learning and cultural, historical understanding of the country? Or what other kind of things could there be to kind of make them more effective?
There we go. Okay, let's take this.
Great. On some German realism, I was in Berlin a few weeks ago, thank goodness for Germany at the moment. I was very struck by the extent to which people around Chancellor Merkel feel very isolated at the moment. They see uncertainty in France. They see us going through whatever we're going through. They see, obviously, the American transition, and they see the funding by Russia of right-wing parties across Europe. But also the fact that Germany has been so much in the front line of the refugee crisis. So I really felt that fragility and that sense that, and this is really the point about I was making about Brexit not being a local issue, that I think it has raised really fundamental questions of identity in Germany. Questions which haven't been discussed in that way for a long time. If the European project fails, into which the German leadership has put so much emphasis over the recent decades, what is there to fall back on? It's a real worry, and we rely massively at the moment on Merkel finding a way through those big questions. But your question was really about how do we make the vision a reality? I don't know, but I think you have a duty to make those arguments, even if you're not confident that they will all be adopted. I did a review of the Foreign Office from January to March, and much of this stuff is in the review. As I say, not everyone was convinced by it. There is a much more pragmatic, realist strand in British diplomacy, and there will always be that debate. But I think we do need to put the sense of our values really back at the heart of the conversation Britain has with the world. We'll see. Let's see in a few years' time. I think perhaps it will be easier once we're through the Brexit process, that until then, we're inevitably going to be in this quite febrile atmosphere, and it's going to be harder to be more internationalist and bold. I think we'll get probably quite a lot of internationalist rhetoric, but it's harder to actually deliver behind that. Fergal, on Ireland, we can have a conversation all night about this. My wife is Irish, and I was travelling to Belfast and Dublin and so on over the summer. I used to work as the PM's Northern Ireland advisor, so I used to spend a lot of time in those very difficult meetings, really battling kind of inch by inch for the peace process. I'm really worried, actually, about the implications for the peace deal. It's very, very difficult to see how to resolve some of those really tricky questions around the border. And there's a danger that there is insufficient kind of bandwidth when everyone else is worrying about all the other aspects of Brexit. I wrote a paper for Number 10 shortly after the referendum saying they should really bring back some real heavyweights to chair a commission basically on the implications of Brexit for the peace process. Because I think you just need some heft there. But you also need something, a mechanism for people to vent their worries and frustrations and to absorb some of that. And in the absence of that, again, nature abhors a vacuum, and people will be pushing for those repositionings, which is really frightening. Isabella, on effective embassies. So I had this proposal in Beirut that was rejected quite quickly, that we didn't need an embassy anymore, that we didn't need a building. The building didn't project power in any way in the way that I wanted my embassy to project power. It wasn't somewhere that people came because they wanted to learn about languages or watch premiership matches or kind of match up with UK, connect with UK people or watch a Shakespeare play. Because we were just surrounded by an army who were trying to stop people killing me. And so it didn't do all the things that I want an embassy to do. Originally, an embassy wasn't a building. An embassy was an idea. It was like a mission that you sent out. And somehow, over the years, we got very into our bricks and mortar. the bureaucracy took over. And that, for me, is not... And I encourage you to read the book. There's a chapter on what the embassy of the future will look like, or should look like. My suggestion in Beirut was that we quit the building and we got a boat, a ship. And my plan was that we would moor the ship in Beirut port and do events on that. The military guys would be based with the military. The humanitarian guys would be based in the Bekaa Valley, closer to where the refugees were. And if there was a crisis, we'd just sail off to Cyprus. And that was one of the ideas where the vision didn't meet reality.
Great. More questions? Come straight down here. And then gentleman at the front.
And then lady on. Yep. Hi, my name's Amelia. I'm a sixth form student. You say that our phones are capable of having a positive effect on humanity, but how would you go about doing this?
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Brett from America, master's student at LSE. I was wondering if you could speak to the progress and lack of progress you've seen from the UK government since the June 23rd referendum in actually executing Brexit.
Okay. And one more, lady just here. Quickfire questions, excellent.
I'm Roseanne. So, Tom, I thought I was particularly interested in your point about loss of curiosity being one of the greatest dangers that we face. Hi. And it's something that I found very interesting during the referendum. So I'm from the West Country and I work in London. And during the referendum campaign, my Facebook feed was full of people who were very pro-Remain, and I very rarely saw a pro-Brexit opinion. My friends back in the West Country, it was completely vice versa. And so when the result came through, we were both, I think, very, very surprised at the volume of votes for the other side. So my question is really, where social media is potentially contributing to a kind of narrowing of our worldview. What's your advice on how we can tackle that? Because it just seems to me that otherwise we'll just end up talking to each other in ever increasingly extreme ways.
Great. Mia, you're right. We've got to think of it in a more practical way about how we use a smartphone. And it's not about the cute cats and so on. Although I've got nothing against cute cats at all. Let me just some practical examples. One thing we're doing with the Global Business Coalition for Education is trying to build a database where companies and individuals who want to help get kids to school globally can offer their services, their time, their ingenuity, and then we can matchmake them, like kind of Tinder for giving, with people who need that support. So, for example, if a head teacher in the Bekaa Valley with double shift school system in place needs some paint for the school, rather than going to an NGO that goes to the UN, they can go directly to Dulux, who will provide that paint. So that's a practical way that you use this extraordinary tool to connect people directly. If someone here wants to give lectures to students who've been displaced from a university that's been bombed, we can try and find a way of doing that. But making those connections. Another example, I'm doing a report at the moment for the UN on how we use technology to help the UN deliver its mandate more effectively. And so we're looking at, for example, can machine learning help you do a peace process? Can location devices, location technology help you do your humanitarian response by identifying more quickly where the problems are? Can artificial intelligence help in negotiation? So there are all sorts, there are real ways that you can use not just social media, but digital technology more widely to crack these big issues. Executing Brexit, you have to work out your position. It's a very complex issue. But in a way, I quite welcome the fact that they didn't just come out the day after and say, right, here's what we're going to do. Because by now, that plan would have not survived contact. It is extraordinarily complex. They had to put the team in place to develop the plan, but it's we're about ready for it now, I'd say, so the sooner the better. Not least because it's the longer it goes on, the more uncertainty there is. But I don't know. I suppose my experience of particularly working in Number 10 is that we made so many mistakes because we were trying to go at the pace of the 24/7 media. And when I got to number 10, we judged our policy by how it would look on the Sky ticker. By the time I left number 10, we judged our policy by how it looked in a tweet. So when a government actually says, do you know what, we need to take some time and think about this properly, then I think that's quite welcome, because not many parts of government have that ability to step back from the day-to-day buffeting of the media. Curiosity, absolutely. We've got to be more curious. My Twitter account, like probably most people's, is a bit of an echo chamber. I hear a lot of views from people who believe in who believe the same things as me, have the same worldview as me. It comes back to your first question: how do we break out of that and actually have conversations with people who don't share our views? My counterexample of that is Hezbollah in Beirut. I wasn't, for slightly odd reasons, allowed to have any communication, direct communication with Hezbollah. And so that was probably the most powerful political grouping in Lebanon. I think I was probably the only ambassador in the world who didn't have a relationship with the most powerful people in the country in which they were serving. And so I engaged the community that they represented online. And so I'd have arguments, as I do now, with Syrian regime people online that I wouldn't be able to have in person, because I was either it was either impossible to, or at times because I couldn't leave the house because of the security situation and death threats. And so social media gave me a means to actually take on those arguments that I wouldn't have had before, and to get out of that echo chamber. But it's, you know, we've got to get out of our comfort zones.
Tom, to pick up this echo chamber question, to what extent do the social media companies writing the algorithms that determine what you see have a responsibility to make sure that, you know, the coverage that we get on our social media feeds are balanced in the way that our mainstream media has a responsibility to be balanced and transparent?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to give... I don't want to see these the big tech companies get more powerful, actually. And I worry about anything that's too interventionist. I think it's fundamentally up to us to use these tools in that more curious, intelligent, engaging way, and actually to restrain the tech companies from putting too much design around that process. I think, but we're building the plane as we fly it. We're still learning how to become phono sapiens. We haven't yet cracked it, and so too often we're leaving that terrain to the bad guys, to the people like Trump who seem to be communicating in this authentic, different way, and, you know, more dangerously even, and this was a big factor for me in the Middle East, to the radicalizers and the extremists who are very effective at using gaming technology, for example, to get into people's minds. And it's a tricky one, this, because I don't think that someone who is close to being radicalized is suddenly going to be unradicalized because the British ambassador in Lebanon sends a tweet. And I don't think we should overclaim on this, but we do have to collectively fill that space more effectively. Not just governments, it's got to be individuals.
Okay, great, we've got time for another round of questions. It's got one here. Gentleman in the green shirt there. Okay, go ahead, yep.
Hi, you've been saying how we are moving... you've been saying how we've been moving towards this idea economy and an age of technological change, and I agree this is the way the world is moving, but the creative destruction this could cause at this rate of technological change, automation could start reducing unemployment, particularly in the lower skilled industries, and this will drive up inequality further and could further undermine the trust in these institutions that could cause us to turn inwards further if we don't deal with these in the long run. So how would you suggest that global policy can be adapted so that we adopt the benefits of this technological change without having its negative consequences?
Right, thank you. Gentlemen over here, keep your hands up, guys, so I can... Gentleman in the green sweater there. Sorry, go ahead.
Hi, Rob, LSE graduate. I read the book. I love how you're encouraging a more entrepreneurial set of public policies. I love how the ambassador of the future is going to come from a multidisciplinary background. I love how you're putting an emphasis on looking for upside as opposed to mitigating downside of very entrepreneurial mentality. My question is, how do you inculcate that? I think you were very lucky, to an extent, working in the FCO, which encouraged you to take risks. You admit yourself that it was a big risk to get into these social media debates. How do you inculcate that mentality within organizations, public sector, private sector, within the family, NGOs, etc.?
Hello. My name is Gela. I come from Georgia. I'm a master's student at the LSE. So my question is about handling the Brexit. There are many talks now about this Brexit phenomena, about the hard Brexit in particular. So from your standpoint, what can be done to make it like less painful by the UK government? Thank you.
How can it be made less painful, Brexit? One more up here.
Hello, Ibtissam from Beirut, Lebanon. How will Brexit impact the relation with Russia? So we saw that many people were thinking that now Russia will become a more, you'll need more Russia as a trade partner. But at the same time, we saw what happened last week in the UN about Aleppo and so on. So how would the UK conciliate between its economic interests and the political problem it has with Russia?
Okay, great. Tom, we've got about 10 minutes to deal with those four.
Okay. So I'll do some quick responses then. I think on, mainly because the questions are getting even harder and my brain's slowing down. On tech and automation, the best thing to do, I would recommend, is read a book by a guy called Alec Ross, who was Hillary Clinton's innovation advisor, called Industries of the Future, which can address these questions far better than I can, and really looks at, so what are the industries that we should be training our kids for now? What are the areas that will create the jobs which we're destroying at the moment through disruption? We haven't talked about artificial intelligence, but you know there are clearly some massive issues there about what happens when that starts to get beyond our control. My concern, I mean, who comes up with these answers? In 1815, when Europe was, you know, in maybe a similar moment of uncertainty, the elites got together, the aristocrats. I was going to say people like me, but I would have been cleaning the chimney or something at the time. But the diplomats got together for months and months and met in Vienna and drank together and ate together and stitched up Europe. And it pretty much held, for much of that century. Who do you put in the room now? You couldn't. If Britain called a great power summit to talk about the future of innovation, I very much doubt that it would have a much real-world impact, if we're really honest. If the permanent five members of the Security Council got together in Vienna next week to try and look at the issue of artificial intelligence, it's a symptom of the decline of the nation state and of those old power structures that we just don't have the authority to do that anymore. But the problem is no one's quite taken up that issue. And so you have this sort of hybrid model of the kind of Davos conferences and the humanitarian model where you sort of have the NGOs are there, the host governments, the donor governments, but no one quite knows who's in charge anymore. And then you then have a celebrity campaign where a film star tweets a picture and you have a hashtag and you hope that's going to make the problem go away. We don't yet know what the right coalitions are to tackle these issues. But I suppose my message is, again, just don't wait for government. Really don't wait for government, particularly on these issues around how technology is changing society. Ram, thank you for reading the book. I'm sorry to have repeated a bit of it just now. I always felt that with social media, there were great risks, including the fact that terrorists would use my smartphone as a means to track where I was. And so tweeting very directly made me more vulnerable. So there were real risks to being on it. And I'm surprised there hasn't yet been an ambassador fired for Twitter. There have been a few slips. I made a few of them myself. We all do. But the biggest risk is not to be on it. Incidentally, I only had to delete two tweets in 4 years in Lebanon. Once when I tweeted from a yacht, and the Foreign Office sent me a very quick message saying that's not quite the image we want our ambassadors to project anymore. We sold more yachts in Lebanon than anywhere else in the world, but even so, I deleted the tweet. And the other one was, I tweeted, and this was fair enough, actually, I tweeted about the pension strikes. And it's a classic example of where we're kind of still working out the rules on social media. So I tweeted solidarity with people who were on strike over civil service pensions. Unfortunately for me, the tweet was then put on Sky News. And so the PM saw it and sent me a very crisp message saying, take it down. And he was right, because I was tweeting from a government account. You know, and you can't have it both ways. You try and bring your personality to the account, but you can't tweet personal views on a government account in that way. Training, though, I do think you can train people in these skills in a more effective way. You see people like Anthony Seldon doing it in the way that they're trying to teach resilience and courage and grit and so on in schools. What we're trying to do in Abu Dhabi at the moment is develop a curriculum on 21st century skills that looks at some of those areas. Next week I've got one of the world's greatest adventurers coming to talk to future diplomats about courage, for example. So you've got to bring in those ideas from outside the sectors. We've all got to be much better at crossover than we have been in the past, at harvesting the best ideas from these different worlds. And just to finish on that, my project for next year, hopefully, is trying to write a curriculum, a 21st century global curriculum, which doesn't really exist at the moment. But what is it that we want every 16-year-old in the world to try to learn? How can we make Brexit less painful? There's going to be some pain, and we have to assume there will be some pain, and people campaigning to leave, to be fair to them, never said there wouldn't be pain. How can we make it less painful? I think we have to try and cauterize it, to try and contain it, and to have a space where we're debating with Europe our relationship with Europe going forward, but then not to then have this corrosive effect, this damage on everything else we do, and not to stop doing everything else, not to stop doing the humanitarian work or the work at the UN Security Council or the reinvigoration, as I said, of the idea of responsibility to protect, the promotion of creative industries, promotion of our education sector. Not just stop all of that, because we're also consumed with Brexit. In a way, we've got to double down, do even more of that, so that we contain the pain. Brexit and Russia. You're closer to the eye of the storm, of course, in Beirut. When you look at Russia's approach to Syria, you see the international order that we've painstakingly constructed between us all coming apart. The rivets are popping because they have basically, while saying we don't believe in a military solution, they've gone for a military solution. And while claiming to be targeting terrorists, they've targeted the group that we need to still be there at the end of all this to help rebuild Syria. They've doubled down on their guy while claiming that they're open to a political process, and it's been deeply deeply cynical, and they've done that while all the while convincing maybe us gullible policymakers that they're serious about negotiation and serious about diplomacy. And I don't see that. I don't think Brexit's going to change that approach massively, but it will encourage more mischief. I mentioned the funding of right-wing parties in Europe. Look at the leak of the WikiLeaks stash in the States. It's going to encourage more of that kind of random. There's not a great plan to it. There's not some strategic genius in Moscow either, but that kind of random mischief and those random attacks on the global order. And I think that should deeply worry all of us.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. It's been a fantastic, a wide-ranging conversation. You guys have all asked nice, important questions and short questions, which is always good. You can continue to tweet them to Tom or to the LSE Brexit hashtag. He has promised to answer all of them at a future date. If you want, Tom will be signing books outside the Lecture Theatre afterwards, where they're available for sale as well. You just join me in thanking Tom Fletcher with the usual...